Radio.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio. I'm your host, John Darlington. This is the 19th of May of 2021. And my guests tonight are the Timmons Brothers, and we will be talking about The Bee Gees, A Tale of Two Bands. When Charles Dickens wrote A Tale of Two Cities in 1859, there was not a thought this phrase could be modified over 120 years later in reference to A Tale of Two Bands. Dickens opened his great novel with the famous lines, "It was the worst of times, and it was ironically, it was the best of times, and it was the worst of times." And ironically, this may also reflect on the band we're talking about, who in the focus of tonight's show, the Bee Gees, Barry, Robin, and Maurice, may explain why their acceptance speech into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Barry stated, "We are, in fact, the enigma with a stigma. We know this. We're aware of it. We hear it every day. We live with it. We have suffered." I don't know how much you suffered, guys, but anyway. But tonight, yeah, I think he's worth $72 million last time I checked, so that's not too bad.
You're not suffering much.
Not that much. But tonight we have come home with this honor. As to A Tale of Two Bands, in the late 60s and 70s, they were especially successful as pop balladeers, with Robin's lead vocals with the hallmark of their earlier hits. After a seemingly long hiatus, they reemerged in the late 70s with an entirely different sound, led by Barry on his falsetto vocals, bringing disco to the mainstream and a cultural impact throughout the world. How big of an impact, may you ask? Well, to the point that numerous rock artists, from the Rolling Stones to Kiss to McCartney and even the Grateful Dead, to name a few, did the unthinkable and released disco-flavored singles in the late 1970s. So join the Timmons Brothers and their exploration of the Bee Gees, A Tale of Two Bands. Tonight, the Timmons Brothers will be called from this point on the BTs, the Brothers Timmons.
That's a new title. Thank you, John.
Yeah, yeah. See, I just thought of that. So that's why I'm not worth $72 million. That just proves that.
I would like to suffer that same way.
Yeah, that would be something else. And I would imagine that's a low ball. That's probably, I don't know. That was something I just saw where they have these things pop them, is, and it'll tell you what a celebrity's worth. But this is a band that I enjoy all of their stuff. And I'm not just saying that. I really do. I enjoy their earlier stuff. It took me a while to get by the vocals because they're so different and they're so shaky and with all the vibrato and but it's what you guys probably understand this and know this, but that's what the bluegrass community calls blood harmony. That's when brothers and sisters and people in a family harmonize. There's something magical to it. There's something that you can't, under any circumstances, do it outside of the family. It's just natural. And
you know, John, even like the Brothers Gibb, I'll bring this up. Their very first time when the twins and Barry won a radio contest when he was 7 and they were 5. And they won a singing contest doing stuff by the Letterman. So at a radio contest when he's very young in Brisbane, Australia. So it's amazing about them. And they just hadn't got ready for the disco ball yet. But
well, you know, that shows you they were, you know, it would be interesting to know what part their parents had in it. I don't know if you guys know that. You know, most of the time when you have people that young or you have a situation like that, the parents are very active in that and getting them, you know, out of schools and things of that nature. And it's kind of interesting. I want to throw this out there and then I'll open it up to you guys. You talked about how that the Bee Gees cross the line into disco. And if you listen to their songs, although, you know, I was never an enemy of disco. I don't know why, but I wasn't. But the other bands kind of jumped on board. Do you think, well, it's like if you try anything and it works, you know, you try something in and put it out there and it starts making money. And I mean, they were making all kinds of money with crowds of people and with, you know, in genres that they had never expected to. So now they're crossing over. I mean, I was thinking about this too, guys. They started off like in a mercy beat band. They went to a more of a rock and roll band. They went basically into a pop band. Then they were a disco band. They did some soul. They did just about everything. And my goodness, I mean, that takes a lot of talent. And when these other guys, like you said, McCartney and the Grateful Dead, when they saw that, they started thinking, you know, we want in on this. It's like, I don't really care what people think about it.
Yeah. Hey, John, I got to bring up about the Kinks. The Kinks saw Saturday Night Fever, and it was Dave and Ray Davies. They was watching this. And Dave Davies, I read this in their biography. Dave Davies said, that'll never get big. And they saw it was getting big. So Ray goes to the studio. He just got done reading a Superman comic book. And he said, boy, I wish I could fly like Superman. So he hurries and gets it down. Rushes it to the rest of the Kinks. The rest of the Kinks are not, I don't know about this. I don't think this is going to be good. We're not disco. Lo and behold, he talked him into it. It was one of the Kinks' biggest sellers on a 12-inch single, and that's the influence of the Bee Gees had on even the Kinks.
Yeah, I mean, you got to try, David, what's working. And a lot of these guys had come out, and I'm sure John's going to touch on this, but a lot of these guys had come out of kind of a dying era. You know, it was like you're really famous. You got the Mop Tops. You're yeah, you're doing all that, and everybody's on board with you. And then all of a sudden, things just start changing and shifting. And a lot of these bands didn't shift with it. They stayed the same. And some of them, you know, were successful and a lot of them weren't. But, you know, Rod Stewart comes to mind. You know, he was a rocker at one point. A lot of people don't realize that. But Mackie May and when he was in the Faces. And then he did the same thing, didn't he, guys? He did disco. I mean, they had to have good managers, don't you think, guys? I mean, telling them, hey, the money is here.
Yeah, Exactly. Hey, John, tell about Rod Stewart, JT. Tell him about that.
Well, Rod Stewart, you know, he kind of shies when they bring it up that he made this song, but possibly his biggest selling song, I don't know this for sure, was Do You Think I'm Sexy? And it was very disco. And, I mean, it was huge. It was a big hit. If anyone would have envisioned the same singer that Every Picture Tells a Story, Donut, or Gasoline Alley, there's no way they would have thought several years later he'd be doing a song, Do You Think I'm Sexy, with that disco beat, you know?
Yeah.
And also for these bands, these groups, it takes an artist like a Ray Davies who's willing to take a risk, and the rest of the band's like, I don't know about this. And I think you can just imagine – when Paul Stanley was telling Gene Simmons, hey, I want to do I Was Made for Loving You, let's do disco. Well, when Gene Simmons
Gene
heard money, he's like, okay, well, if it's going to make money, sure, Paul, let's do it, you know.
Yeah.
But it takes someone in the band who's willing to step out, because I'm sure each time there was this sort of a delicate type of situation going on. I don't know who was the one that pushed for it within the Grateful Dead. It'd be interesting to find out. But I wonder, you know, it was the song is called Shakedown Street. Actually, a pretty good tune, I think.
It was Bob Weir, John.
Oh, it was Bob Weir. Okay, he's the
one
that
was pushed for it. Jerry Garcia was against it.
Okay, see, I figured there was, know, a lot of you know, people who weren't going along with it. And so Weir was the risk taker in that case. That song, in my opinion, when you see a best of collection or greatest hits, they seem to leave it off. I guess like, oh, we don't want to include that.
Really?
Know?
Yeah.
But I like it. I like it.
Well, Jake Gals band, John, we mentioned them. They made the song Flamethrower. And you talk about a band getting out of their safety zone. When you think of the Jake Gals band, you think of blues and rock and roll. And when they, if you listen to Flamethrower, that disco drums in it and everything else. And there again, Peter Wolf and Jake was willing to take that step, like you said, and take that chance. But now you guys mentioned the Rolling Stones. Mick and Keith, they went from glitter to disco, whatever sold records they weren't afraid to do.
Yeah, you're right. And I think that's management. And it's like – but we could probably name a couple bands. You guys probably could name a couple bands that, you know, didn't do that, wouldn't do that. There's no way they would go into that for money. And I can't think of any right off the top of my head, but there's probably a few that did that. That, you know, their management would say, hey, we need to get into this, you know. But it was a big thing then. It was disco versus rock and roll. And it was like disco sucks, T-shirts everywhere. People were really against it. And it's so funny to me. It's like, you know, it was you had the nightclub. You had the John Travolta. You had the, like we were talking, David, you had the leisure suits and the chains, and you had that whole scene. And then you had the, you know, the rock and roll dudes over here, you know, they're not going to compromise anything. And it was quite a time. I remember, you know, listening to, I've always said this, and you guys know this, everybody on that's listening, and we do have a couple callers, and we're going to get to you in just a minute, that a good song is a good song. And it doesn't matter to me if it's a country song, a bluegrass song, a rock and roll song, a disco song, whatever. You hear a good song, it's like, you know, didn't Barry Gibbs write Islands in the Stream, I think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And well, then he wrote a whole album for Barbara Streisand.
Yeah.
And you look, but here's what I always said about the Bee Gees. When they did this Saturday Night Fever, they had no idea what they were really opening. I think, though, this is my own opinion on this, and John's heard me talk about this before. Were we trapping ourselves now into an image of being disco kings? You cross this line. Do you want to be a rock artist, like you said, JD, or do you want to be, in which they end up being disco kings, because all four of their songs charted number one on Billboard, and which was amazing, counting all the other disco bands on that. But like I said, when they make a Mount Rushmore, it's got to be all the Gibb brothers on that Mount Rushmore for disco.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to take some calls here, John, but go ahead. And I know you probably have, you know, an intro into the show and what we want to cover tonight so that we can lay that down, get that foundation out there, and talk about what we really is the most. I mean, people hear the Bee Gees and they think of songs, and that's pretty cool, but there's a lot behind that. What do you think we should talk about tonight?
Well, I think one of the things we can talk about tonight, John, is the unique sound of brothers that can harmonize. And, yeah, you know, this is a comparison with the Beach Boys, in my opinion. The difference was their dad, who was also in the music entertainment business, he was their manager for a while, too. But unlike Murray Wilson, he knew when to get out and let somebody else do it. And that was a big difference. In fact, when the Bee Gees got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, the person who did the induction was Brian Wilson. And in his speech to induct him, he talked about the life of being brothers doing harmony. And we didn't know while we were doing it in Hawthorne, California, on the other side of Rill in Australia, there was three brothers doing their own thing, you know. He said during his speech, he goes, they had the song "Too Much," nobody gives too much heaven anymore. And right in his speech, he said that song is heavenly. He goes, I wish I would have written that. You know,
it is,
and that's come from Brian Wilson. You know, so
yeah.
And I think you can draw that type of comparison. Something about brothers that you just can't get that sound and anywhere else. You think of the Everly Brothers; they had their own style, particularly when it comes to harmonizing. And I think that was one thing, was a common thread throughout the career of the Bee Gees, was this ability to do the harmony, be it pop, be it rock, be it the rhythm and blues, be it the disco. They did retain that, and I think that's what set them aside from so many of the other artists. And even in disco, you don't think of harmonizing for disco, typically.
Right.
But by gosh, the Bee Gees were able to incorporate it in almost a flawless manner. And so these are some of the things I think we need to be thinking about tonight. I think that people are starting to reassess how they feel about the Bee Gees. They've been enough years removed from the days when the bombs were exploding between games of a doubleheader, when it was at Comiskey Park in Chicago, and blowing up records. I think his name was Steve Dahls, was the DJ at WLS in Chicago. Yeah, I remember in 78, 79, seeing those T-shirts everywhere. Disco sucks,
one.
There you go. Clean up America, get rid of the Bee Gees. You know, I mean, it was common.
John, you brought some good points before we go to the callers, too. But I also want to talk about the tragedies these brothers faced up. People don't realize that they had a lot of things happen to them in all these sets of music they went to, which I'll get more into when we talk more about it, because it wasn't all spice and cake for them. There was a lot of times where it wasn't an easy road for them to hoe, and we'll bring that up later.
They really suffered a lot, and that's what they said in their speech. And I guess they did. So we'll say they did. But, okay, so let's take some callers, and let's get this thing rolling. The first one on tonight is 740-506-4575. You're on John Talk Radio.
Yes, it's Fran from east of the Ohio.
Hi, Fran.
How you doing, Fran?
Hey, Fran.
Philadelphia, yeah, I threatened Fran. I'd be on. Yeah, well, hey, listen, a point about getting back to what was brought up just a little while ago about management. I've got some research sitting here, so I'm not. I agree with you. It took me a while to actually develop an appreciation for the Bee Gees, but let me go back to what I was about to say about management. You know that the Bee Gees were born in Manchester. And then in 1958, the family migrated to Australia. And as was brought out earlier, you know, they were doing, the little kids doing the talent shows and all that. Well, as time went on, they realized that they were pretty good. And as hard as they tried, they couldn't get the airplay needed in Australia. And at that time, the Easy Beats were number one in Australia. And so what happens, they signed with a guy by the name of Robert Stigwood, an Australian who brought them to London. Now get this, Stigwood, in partnership with the late Brian Epstein, groomed the Bee Gees for stardom. And part of that, no, it says right here in this rock encyclopedia, no expense was spared in arrangements, we know that, production, studio time, or publicity.
And you know,
and,
you brought up a good point here too. Just like Epstein did with the Beatles, he groomed them for what he wanted from them. Basically changed their hairstyles and did everything that to get what he wanted, and even introduced them to Eric Clapton, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And so, yes.
But, you know, as far as the sound is concerned, I mean, I've seen it a couple of times, and no doubt you guys have too. Pardon me. The PBS special One Night Only, that was taped in Las Vegas, where they kind of did a an intro for Olivia Newton-John. Mm-hmm. And the quality of that taping, if you will, that production, it did justice to every talent that each of those guys had, well, now have and had. Mm-hmm. And it just mesmerized me. I mean, wow.
Yeah, it was well done, no doubt about. And what I liked about that production, and I also got to say this, if you want to see really good rock and roll, you have to watch PBS, it seems like, if you want to see it on TV. If you don't have thousands of channels on cable. But, that was well done. And, you know, I want to go back, Fran, to your comment about Robert Stigwood. Yes, not only did he groom them, but he took a big risk, signed them to a 5-year contract. You know, that's a big commitment for a group that really hadn't made it yet. And, 5 years. And, boy, he came out well, though, because I was signed in 67. So we all know the number of hits they had in the next 5 years. It was it led Robert Stigwood to doing his own label, RSO Records, and all the artists they had. Throughout the 70s, particularly on that label.
And John, if you remember,
well, you know
right,
what I meant.
Yeah, you guys remember Atlantic Records were not too sure about them, and Stigwood had so much pull at that time before he could start his own label. And remember, he's the one that's actually started ATCO Records, a division of Atlantic. And so he knew what he had.
Good point.
But he was a gambler too, because if this don't work, I'm out of a lot of cash. But he knew what he was doing, guys.
Well, you know, I mentioned earlier, it took me a while to acquire the taste for the Bee Gees. But, you know, I go back to, I appreciate it now. But when I first heard New York Mining Disaster, I thought, wait a while, what is this thing? Is this a news report or what? And, you know, now you go back on it and say, whoa.
Yeah. You would think it was a real story, just like Gordon Lightfoot did with the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, you know?
Yeah,
And that wasn't the case. I mean, I don't think there was actually, now correct me if I'm wrong, but from my research, am I right on this? There wasn't actually a 1941 New York mining disaster?
No, there really wasn't. They saw a movie with Gary Cooper in it from 41.
Oh, okay.
And Gary Cooper gets dropped in a coal cave-in.
But they're so real, you would think it happened that they're singing about
it. Yeah. Well, look at
the
movie.
Well, that's the point right there.
Hey, guys, we don't know if there was a Sloop John B.
That's true. Good one. Let me ask you a question, Fran. When was the song that turned it around for you to kind of give the Bee Gees another listen? Like, I heard you say you weren't really at first into the Bee Gees. It took a while. Was there any particular song or songs that, you know, I think I will listen to this group a little bit?
Yeah, there one that really stands out in my mind is Jive Talkin'. Now that's going to shed a little light on the fact that yours truly loves R&B and soul.
Yes.
When I heard the way that it was so smooth, and yet it had a little, undeniably it had some funk in it.
Hey, Fred, it's my favorite too. That's why I was grinning. I love that song. It's a good one.
Yeah, they could do. Could do soul, rhythm and blues, rock, mercy beat. They could do anything, and that's what I think is. You can say I like it, I don't like it, whatever. But man, they were so talented musicians. It's incredible.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And do you guys know who the keyboard player was for them for a while? And he's with one of the bands, one of my favorite bands. And
oh no, Mata Hoople.
Blue Weaver. Before that's how Morgan Fisher got to join the band. When Blue Weaver left Mata Hoople, and they was having big hits, and Blue
well,
Weaver.
Did he go all the way to Memphis?
Yeah, he did, and he knew a few of the young dudes too. I got him in, guys.
Dude, David, I was worrying that you wouldn't be able to get him in, but that was awesome. Good job.
A little bit harder this time, fellas.
Yeah, you're up to the challenge, no doubt about it. Let's take one more caller, and then we'll play a song. Okay, let's see. 864-710-0475, you're on John Talk Radio.
Hello, John, and Dave. Nice to hear from you this evening. I've known John Timmons. I know Dave Timmons. This is Brady Cross.
Hey, Brady.
Hi, Brady. Oh, how you doing, Brady?
All right. All right. Well, I tell you what, I've got a couple stories about the Bee Gees. When I was a little boy, my dad and I grew up in the early 80s. My dad used to be in the jukebox business. And he had records. He'd buy the jukeboxes, and they'd come with records. He'd pull the records out of them and refurbish the jukeboxes. Well, he wouldn't put records back in when he sold the jukeboxes. He just threw them in a box. So he ended up with these boxes and boxes of 45 records.
Wow.
45
That's
RPMs.
Awesome.
Yeah, it really is. And John Timmons and I used to go through them. And
yes,
I still have, oh, yeah, we had a ball with that. And we had, I remember the Bee Gees label, the label for the Bee Gees records very well, with the RSO on them. And it very much stood out because when I was real little, I didn't really look at the bands. I didn't really know who the bands were, but I looked at those labels and I said, that's going to be a good song right there. And I'd pull them out by label. Well, of course I kept all the Bee Gees records. They were great.
Yeah.
And Dave, to your point about Flamethrower, that was one of the records.
Oh, wow.
Jay Giles, man.
Wow. Hey, Brady, that's a good song, too. It's a good song.
Yeah, it is. It really and truly is. And,
Brady, if I can tell this story, now I'll let you go back, but I just got to share this with the listeners. Brady was so generous that he would go back to his home in Seneca, South Carolina area, and from his dad, bring back boxes and boxes of 45s. And you know how I am with there. To me, records are a gold mine. And I would have so much fun on weekends just recording one 45 after another of songs I'd forgotten about from everything from the 60s, 70s, into the 80s. And so I really appreciated that, Brady.
Oh, yeah, well, I've had a lot of fun. You know, we had, you know, I always remember the Bee Gees, the Steve Miller Band, and all kinds of great songs from the late 70s were in that collection. And, you know, those records still survive today, even though they went through a tornado and they got scattered all the way about. Some of them are still around. And I'm proud to say we still got some of them.
Now, Brady, did any of them records end up in Oz after the tornado?
Well, one of them ended up in a tree, and they ended up all over the place, Dave. I mean, they were The tornado took things for over 30. There were things found 30 miles away from that tornado.
Wow.
Hey, Brady,
yeah.
I do have one question for you. What do you think about the bands like the Kinks and them when they went to disco? I know you're into rock and roll, too. Did it kind of surprise you that other bands would try to do disco?
Well, not at all, because disco had a very genuine sound. It was not made up of something else. It wasn't just I hesitate to use the word fad, but the sound was a legitimate sound. Because you're talking to a Grateful Dead fan here. Now, the hundreds of hours of Grateful Dead I have on CD, I have two LPs by the Grateful Dead. One of them is Shakedown Street.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so that one endures and has a really neat sound to it. And to hear that song played live, the way they hit it, it really was phenomenal. It was magical when they played it on stage.
Man.
Now, you were a big Dead fan. Was it Bob Weir that wanted to go that direction, or was it Garcia? I've heard two different stories on this, and I know you're a big Grateful Dead fan.
Well, I do know that in interviews that I've seen and heard that Bob Weir and Jerry Garcia, neither one of them would confirm nor deny that it was a disco song.
Okay.
They said, you know, they played music. The Grateful Dead honored music from and celebrated music of different genres throughout the years. They had a song by Buddy Holly called "Not Fade Away" that was part of their repertoire from the first days to the end. So they really did get into it, and they would play those songs to appreciate the artist. Well, because the disco was such a big deal and it was so short-lived, they didn't really have a way to pay tribute to anyone with disco, so they created their own song. And that's the way Shakedown Street sort of went.
Oh.
And, yeah, and I don't know. Now, that's not factual history. That's my analysis.
Okay.
That's my little head.
I know you would know background, but you've been a Deadhead for a long time. So I figured you
would. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And I do know that, you know, when disco got killed off by the naysayers, the disco sucks crowd and everything, and I don't want to get into the politics of it tonight, but there was the fact that disco died so quickly is a crying shame. But the disco movement did continue to shape music for years and years to come to the present day. It won't go away, and it never will. The sound is just too distinct. Now, are you familiar with the story about how the Bee Gees created the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack?
I know a little bit of the story, Brady.
For it. Right. You know, a lot of folks may not realize that those songs for the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack were recorded in France.
Mm-hmm.
And the Bee Gees were invited to record at a studio, and they kind of made an agreement they would go over there and record. They got to France and found out that the studio was a bit of a dump. It was not nearly the wonderful place that it was supposed to be, despite the fact that Chopin had recorded there, or not recorded, but composed music there.
Mm-hmm.
And they got a phone call from the United States and said, you know, we need you to create some music for this movie we're doing. And they laid down four tracks, I think it was, on a cassette tape and sent it back to the United States. And all four of those songs ended up being number one hit songs.
Yeah.
So, and they created the disco loop on a tape over there, and they took the drum beat because their drummer left due to a family issue, and they didn't have a drummer. So they
was their
took
drummer
a recording
Colin Peterson though at the time?
I cannot remember.
I was wondering, because he played drum with them in the 60s. I just wondered. I was kind of curious.
I couldn't tell you, but I don't think it's the same drummer.
Mm-hmm.
It was a drummer that joined the band when they became a disco band.
I know Blue Weaver was with them.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure, but the drummer had to leave because of due to a family emergency, and they were going to record these tracks. And I said, "Well, you know what? We'll just put it on a loop. We'll play this tape," and they spliced the tape together and ran it through the machine right there in the studio. And they did so manually because it was just literally a looped tape. So, well, we'll record the drums this way for the demo tape. Then when we get back to the United States, we'll record the track for real and put the drummer on it. that never happened.
And lo and behold.
You know that Saturday Night Fever album, guys, we're talking about this. But not only did it kick up the Bee Gees again, you think of Yvonne Elliman. Her whole career, she had struggled and struggled. That one album brought that young lady into big production, same way with KC and the Sunshine Band. It opened up the doors for a lot of bands that would never had a chance and stuff like that, and different singers. Thinking about that. That album, when my brother John bought that, I heard it enough times that I said, I know each song by heart, and this is scary.
Yeah, that's where you got your disco moves.
That's where I got my medallion.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, John.
Go ahead, John. Okay.
No, I was just going to bring on another caller here in a minute.
Another caller? Go ahead. Go ahead, Dan, John. Okay.
Yeah, actually, we have two more callers.
Okay.
Well, I know y'all need to go, so I'm going to say that
Brady.
One other
take
thing.
Take care of yourself, Rand.
Oh, sure, and I will.
Oh, I'm going to hang in.
Okay.
Thanks, Fran. Yeah, you can hang around if you want to. Brady, it's fine if you want to.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's okay with me. We've got plenty of room in the John Talk Radio room. And just for everybody that's listening, this is John Talk Radio. This is May the 19th, 2021. My guests are the BTs, the Timmons, the Brothers Timmons. And
that's John, now.
Yeah, that's a good one. And that's one of my best ones. But we're talking about the Bee Gees, the Tale of Two Bands. It's a great topic. And let's see if we have a couple more callers. Let's open it up here to – let's see. Take a minute here. Hi, 740-412-2910. You're on John Talk Radio.
Hi, John. Hi, David.
Hey, Steve. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing?
I was listening to your show and enjoying it. I got to admit,
that's great.
I like.
Thanks for joining.
And you got to give them their props. But you know, I think the disco music craze wasn't for everybody, and I think a big reason why a lot of people or some people was against the disco music was from the mid '70s to the maybe mid '80s when everything you would watch, you know, on MTV or whatever, was all the disco music. And basically what happened was your folk singer and your singer-songwriter, your acoustical guitar sound took a back seat. You didn't see it very much. And everything
right, that's
with the synthesizer keyboards, you know, that's how the music was made. And I think a lot of people just had missed that sound that was prevalent before the disco craze came about. And, of course, your guitar manufacturers made acoustic guitars, they suffered greatly because their sales just plummeted. And just like, you know, I'm a Martin collector, I'm not getting anything from Martin for saying this, but you know, their sales 1 year was like 23,000, and in 1982 it dropped to 3,000.
Wow.
And Chris Martin told his employees, said, you know, if 3,000 is all we're going to sell, then we're going to make the best guitars we can possibly make.
Wow.
But what was kind of ironic, in 1981, when MTV started, you know, they kind of fueled this or enabled this disco craze. But I think they had the fortitude and the insight later on, about 89, to know that this thing would run its course and go away. And I say that because they actually contacted Martin Guitar and wanted to know if they could bring some acoustical guitars and drop them off at the New York studio. And they had an idea. And they wanted to get these groups to come in and do an acoustical set. Thus, the MTV Unplugged series started. And that in itself, in 1992, when an artist, Eric Clapton, played his set, I guess the phone banks at MTV just lit up like crazy.
And hey, Steve, I remember this. And that's where he did his different version of Layla.
Yes. And everybody wanted to know, what are you playing?
And everything.
The rest is history. From then on, the sales, the acoustical guitars, they came back. You know, everybody, they kind of had their fill of the disco. Okay,
yeah.
They wanted to get back to that sort of folk singer-songwriter, and thus a lot of the industry giants, they credit Eric Clapton for single-handedly rebounding that acoustical guitar.
Hey, Steve, I got a question for you.
They were suffering greatly.
Hey, I got a question for Steve. I know you're into guitars, and I'll tell everybody out there, Steve out there was original member of Fuss and Razor's Edge, so He put up with me for years.
He was an original member.
He's original. But, Steve, imagine if John Denver had went disco. Couldn't you have seen that? If his cowboy hat would have had glitter on it, it would have been interesting. On that part there, but the key thing. But, Steve, I like what you brought up, some good points, and I know J.D. and John are the same way. It did hurt a lot of guys like Bobby Dylan, Denver, and them for a while because it was a craze there. It didn't for 16 months. If you didn't go to disco, you weren't going to sell no records or make any videos. And disco was made for videos, like you brought up. And good points.
And that's why, like you mentioned earlier, the Stones, the Beatles, Paul McCartney, you know, they kind of put a flavor of disco into their music because they knew that was the fad of the moment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were all going to buy into it. But like I said, later on, MTV, they could see that it was winding down, and they kind of fueled this acoustical MTV Unplugged series, which became very popular. And it refueled the desire to once again purchase and make music with acoustical guitars. But
Steve, I just got to let me tell you this story since you're talking about Eric Clapton and the irony of this all. Clapton, yes, he did regenerate the interest in the singer-songwriter and acoustic in 1992 with the Unplugged. But ironically enough, it was Eric Clapton who recommended through Robert Stigwood, RSO Records, that, you know, I've had good success recording down here in Miami, Florida. I found a new sound with his Ocean Boulevard album. And years later, the Bee Gees give him credit for looking into going to Miami where they would change that sound and go into a disco sound. So he not only helped them rise to the top, he helped regenerate the interest in the singer-songwriter as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, guys, have we ever done a show on Eric Clapton?
Yes, we have.
We need to do another one.
I'd love to do another one, you guys, one of these days.
Let's do another.
He's such a legend.
I mean, seriously.
Old slow
hand. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's really good stuff, Steve. I mean, tying that in with the industry, when you're talking about making guitars, and when you're at that point, I mean, the record companies are there to make money. And that's what they're there for. And so, like we were talking earlier, when something comes around and you see, you get these graphs in your meetings and say, uh-oh, ours are going down. This is going up. What do we do, guys? You know, can you write this kind of song? And can we get there? Because everybody wants to be successful. And that's one thing I've talked about the record industry before on with different people, and it's one of those things where it's like so elusive. You try to grab a hold of it and you can't because you don't know. It just floats around, and now it's even weirder than ever with the internet, but they're always trying to stay ahead. It's like a marketing thing, you know, what's going to sell, what's going to be out there.
you guys remember when Dick Clark did American Bandstand and he wore a leisure suit in the later 70s and he came out and everything? And I've, that was the hardest thing for him to bite the bullet for. Here's a guy that discovered Paul Revere and the Raiders. He had discovered all these rock and roll, the Buckinghams. And I, and deep down, he did all the, John, you'll know about this, the Philadelphia sound, and he had all them. But he knew, to stay on the air, he had to have these disco artists on there. And like I said, disco artists to me were very energetic on stage. They gave it all they got, and which was amazing to me.
Yeah, we got another caller, guys. Let's bring him in.
Okay.
So we, 864. Let's see, 219-1174. You're on John Talk Radio. Or is that?
Hey,
you
finally got on. Yeah, I was waiting.
Hey, Andrew.
Everybody.
How you doing,
Andrew? Everyone? It's
thank
good
you for
to hear
waiting.
My buddy Brady again from the 20 years since I heard Brady crawl. So that was a pleasant surprise. I was like, wow, man. Like, can I get on, man? Everybody must love the BG tonight. I'm like, man, I'm waiting. I'm already doing my groceries, my online grocery stuff. For the more, I'm like, I'm listening, but like, can I get on?
We're glad you made it.
So I've been waiting, old man.
Well, thanks for your patience, Andrew. It's good to have you on. I mean, we always like hearing your perspective, and. And, Andrew, have you talked with your mother? Because I know she's an avid Bee Gees fan.
Oh, yeah. She was so excited when you finally decided to do this show. But, unfortunately, she's an early bird. She's already in the bed. So unless y'all record it, she'll be able to hear this. But, of course, you know, my mother, she's a huge Bee Gees fan. I mean, she told me the stories growing up, similar to Brady's dad, how back in the 70s, the disco era, how when the Bee Gees came out, that was just it. I mean, they just loved it. And also, like everyone has said, the Bee Gees got so much swag, the disco sucks and all that. People down, my mother and her friends and her boyfriend, my father, for going for the Bee Gees, saying, y'all can't believe y'all listen to those whiny falsetto singing people and stuff. But my mom's like, the heck with y'all. We love the Bee Gees. Matter of fact, my parents went on a date to see Saturday Night Fever when they came out. That was one of their first movie dates, seeing Saturday Night Fever.
How about
Fever.
That?
Wow.
Exactly.
That's good. And,
yeah.
Yeah. And my mom, she still goes crazy over the Bee Gees. I'm jumping ahead, but, I mean, she even likes the younger brother, Andy Gibbs. She was still heartbroken about talking about the tragedy what happened to him. I mean, she just loves the Bee Gees. I mean, I got her the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack on CD years ago, and every time she hears a Bee Gees song, it takes her back. It's made me a Bee Gees fan. I mean, I have a couple of Bee Gees songs on my Spotify playlist. I'm a little more modern there, and I have a Bee Gees Pandora station, and I just enjoy just the history of it. There's a, I'm sure you're all getting this. Sorry if I'm jumping ahead, but there's actually a good special at HBO, a good documentary. I haven't yet to watch, but it's pretty informative, and it's getting a lot of popularity, but yes.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Andrew, you brought up a good point about Andy Gibb. Gibb was so frustrated. He wanted to be a Bee Gee, and that was
true.
I was going to talk about some of the track. Yes, he got to be a big teen idol, but deep down, he wanted to be like his big brothers, and it affected him so bad mentally. And, hey, John, am I right? Was Maurice wanting to bring him into the band before he died?
Yeah, they were starting to incorporate him a little bit. He was starting to tour him because they were trying to get him away from drugs, and they thought maybe if we keep a better eye on him and have him with us, you know, it'll be like a buffer protection. And he was enjoying it. There's actually films of him performing, doing a good job right there with the other three.
Yes.
Yeah, and also, guys, there's a sister, Gibb.
Yes. Yes,
there
she was the oldest. She was the oldest sibling, right, I believe? Is that right?
Yeah,
you know, Yeah, her name is Leslie, and there's some tracks of her singing with him. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that out there.
You know, guys, the Barry when Barry Gibb was on an interview, and I caught him on my radio one night, and he was talking about Andy, and he brought this up. He said from that point on, he said, I only wish, if hindsight, I would have brought Andy in earlier. And he said, but he said Robin Gibb wanted Andy to earn his oats and let him work his way up. And he said he wished he had spoke up and done what he to bring Andy in. And you always wonder if they had done this, would Andy still been alive, or and he wouldn't have got hooked on all the drugs, or but Robin fought a bad heroin habit. John, if I'm right, he leaves the band Donny John around 1970 and makes a pretty good solo album.
That's right. He certainly does. And then Morris and Barry would continue without him, albums that didn't do too well, how they got him to come back is, ironically enough, is the How Do You Man a Broken Heart. And you think there's some symbolism there because, you know, Robin leaves the band and Barry guarantees him, you'll sing the first part of the song. I really need you back. We need you for the sound. And that was the comeback song when Robin did come back to the band.
And let's we got another caller, so let's bring in another caller. So 614-558-6070, you're on John Talk Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hello, John, JT, and Dave. This is Kurt calling from Gahanna.
Kurt,
hi,
Kurt.
How's everything going in this league?
Kurt is one of our biggest supporters.
Both?
Thank you.
He is.
You know, good hearing from you.
Yeah, well, absolutely. This is a great topic tonight. I've tuned in to many of the other shows, and even when I've had to miss, I've played it later, and it's always good hearing from all three of you. The couple points I wanted to make were a couple of things. So firstly, a band we haven't talked a lot about yet. We touched on them a couple times. I was really at the time, blown away that Kiss stepped out and did the Dynasty album with you know, I Was Made for Loving You, going gold, I believe, that song did. And I think I was kind of blown away by that because that was at a time when they were so hot in the late 70s with what they were already doing. For them to take a step out on that ledge like that, I thought was a really brave thing to do, really.
Well, Kurt, there's a story behind this. Of course, you know I'm a big Kiss fan.
Right.
And when they were listening to this and that thing, well, Gene Simmons was against it. Paul Stanley said, let's go with it. He said, it's got everything we can do. He said, and I know what Gene was afraid of. We're really flying high with our Kiss Army and everything. Well, the Kiss Army let us get by with disco. Well, they did. And the only one that came out of in the bad end was Ace Frehley. Ace Frehley really didn't even want to do what they did. And if you remember, that would be Ace Frehley's last album with Kiss. And
that's right.
Of course, but he wasn't on Gene Simmons' Christmas card list anyway. So we knew this was going to happen. But you're right, though. For a band to take that chance, I brought up the Kinks. The Kinks were a well-known, and while the Rolling Stones were the opposite. Whatever was happening, we're going to do it. Mick would put on makeup.
Yep.
He would do glitter. Mick would, if they were going to do R&B, I'm going to do R&B. It never bothered the Rolling Stones. But you think of some other bands like Jake Gals and them, that was a dangerous step to take.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was, in their case of them, the different ones you just mentioned there, David, it was really a big leap out. But I think the other point I'll make is, and that is, the kind of behind-the-scenes influence that disco had, the subtle songs that influenced by disco. So, for example, you know, I never thought about this, and I read this somewhere, and I said, by gosh, I'm going to listen to that, and they're right. And what it is if you think about Pink Floyd's The Wall, Another Brick in the Wall Part 2, it's got a disco groove to it happening the whole time. Mm-hmm. And you don't really think – it's not a disco song, but it's right. Definitely got a disco influence to it. And that's to me, I think the other aspect of this is all of the things that disco influenced, that they're not blatant disco songs, but they did – it does have that kind of swag to it.
John, I'll add this too, Kurt. It changed the whole culture. I remember – I am an undergraduate student at Miami University, and bars that were playing strict rock and roll, it was something happened over Christmas break that year in 77, 78. December, everybody was rock and roll. We come back in January, they're putting in lighted dance floors. They're playing disco music. They're strobe lights. And I'm talking hardcore rock places. It took this dramatic change. Guys were actually getting on the dance floor. Hadn't seen that since The Twist, probably, you know, and it was just an incredible culture change, you know.
Yeah, it was that John Travolta thing, man. It was like, you know, he had that kind of a doldrum life, and at nighttime he came alive, man, put on his suit, and there it was. He was this super cool dude, and I think that had something to do with it. It was like people wanted to do that. They wanted to go out. They wanted to go to the clubs. They wanted to dance. They wanted the lights. They wanted that whole thing, John. I think that's – and there were people that did not accept it, but a lot of people did. And one thing I want to say, Andrew, that this show is podcasted. It's recorded so your mom can listen to it anytime she wants.
I thought so, yeah. I couldn't 100% remember. I thought so, yeah, but she would enjoy.
You know, guys,
I mean,
I want to bring this up about the Bee Gees. I think, though, this is my own opinion. I think why they had trouble later on, and I almost see how you guys feel about that. I think they got trapped in this disco era. Because you remember, they wanted to do other material, but once you get typecast as certain artists, it's happened to a lot of bands, they could never, I think that's what affected them later, they could never get out of that image. Everybody thought of them as the guys in the white leisure suits and the blue Satan jackets, and I think it kind of hurt them later on down the road, you guys. And I don't know what your opinions are, but I really think it did. I think they got typecast.
Well,
hey,
I can't remember. John, what's you, I think you know, like, the list of hits and stuff like that. I know they had – how many number one hits did the Bee Gees have, John Timmons, in 1978?
In 78 and 79, they had 6 consecutive number one songs just in those 2 years alone.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
And then
yeah.
What's funny, and to Dave's point, first I want to acknowledge Kurt's point. I appreciate that so much about Pink Floyd. I hadn't heard that one before. But back to Dave's point, I think people suddenly grew tired of the Bee Gees, and they couldn't get radio airplay. But you know what? They were songwriters. They weren't just musicians. They were still writing songs, becoming hits. Take, for instance, Heartbreaker, Dionne Warwick, 1982, Islands in the Stream, Dolly Parton and Kenny Rogers, 1983. Those are just 2 examples. Okay, you won't play us? I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get these other artists, and we'll still have number one hits.
Yep. And they will put their Emmys in their little room and collect their $72 million and keep on trucking.
You know, guys, though, this is the hardest thing of being any type of band. I can think of some bands that try – I'll bring up the Dave Clark Five. The Dave Clark Five was a heck of a good band till 67. Sgt. Pepper, they never came back from what they could not duplicate like some of the other bands. Well, it affected a lot of bands. But I think sometimes with the Bee Gees, John, you brought up a good point. They had the gift that the Beatles had, songwriting ability, and that keeps you in the limelight.
Mm-hmm. That's what separates them from so many other artists that we talk about. They were actually songwriters, too.
Well, guys, let's take a music
break. Hey, guys.
We got it. Yeah.
Yeah, just to the point that there was an interview in the January issue of the Saturday Evening Post with Barry Gibb. And he says right here, yes, now this is Barry talking. Yes, I was frustrated when we got stuck with the label disco band. Still, we kept on turning out great music. Looking back, what I regret most is that I fell out with my brothers. But, you know, he says it right here. Ever since Saturday Night Fever, that's what gave him that moniker.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, I guess that's part of the suffering part he was talking about. But anyway, let's take a quick music break. I want to thank everybody that's joined tonight, the callers. Thank you for the great questions and comments. I really appreciate it. And just let people know, if they did miss tonight's show, that it is podcasted 24/7. Anytime you want to listen to, just go to blogtalkradio.com/John-Darlington, and you can pull it right up, or go to my Facebook page, and there'll be a link to it there. We're going to take a couple minutes, play a couple songs. We'll come back, and we'll wrap up the show. We got another half an hour left, and we'll be right back after this. So we'll play a couple BG songs, and we'll let the BTs. We'll let the BTs get a drink of water, and we'll be right back.
The preacher talked with me and he smiled. Said, come and walk with me. Come and walk one more mile. Now for once in your life you're alone. But you ain't got a dime. There's no time for the fool.
Yeah.
want to welcome everyone back to John Talk Radio. I'm your host, John Darlington. We do this every Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. We also have an independent music showcase 50-minute music break we have every Tuesday and Thursday at 12 o'clock noon. All these shows, Tuesday, Thursday, and Wednesday night shows, are all podcasted. You can just go to Blog Talk Radio, John Talk Radio, and you can Google that, take you right there, go to my Facebook page. I also have a Twitter account. And you can listen to these. And actually, we've been doing a lot of these shows with the Timmons Brothers for a long time. So go back in the archives and listen to some of our shows we've done. So that's kind of contrasted a little bit of their career there with I've Got to Get a Message to You and Night Fever. And it just kind of shows how incredibly talented those guys were.
John, the first song you played there, it's about a man going to the electric chair.
Yeah, that's always a
Robin. And
that's a happy song to sing, isn't it? I mean, think about it. They sang about that. They sang about the mining disaster.
Yes, they. I think they kind of like that Heartbreak Hotel song.
Yeah, and they're pop songs. So there you go.
Yeah.
Well, okay. That's let's. John, what else do we need to cover? We've got roughly about 22 minutes or so. In tonight's show, because this is going to be podcast. I know a lot of people like to listen to it on at their own time, and we'll listen to it. And also, I'll throw it out there. We have a lot of music we didn't get to tonight because of the callers, but that's a great thing. It's always a great thing. So the show will end at 9:30, but you can listen. I'll play the music after the podcast. If you're listening live, you won't hear it, but if you're listening on the podcast, you'll be able to hear the rest of the song. So just want to throw that out. But, John, what made you and David want to do a show on these guys? I mean, I know that if you think about it, there's no band like, I mean, of course you have the Beatles, but then you have the Bee Gees that have to have their own part. I mean, people have to pay attention to these guys.
I think in the statement at the opening, when Barry was accepting the Hall of Fame induction on behalf of the Bee Gees, they were an enigma with a stigma. And I think that says a lot. They were different. They were mysterious. John, I heard you say earlier off the air that, you know, he had to get past their vocals at first. It was a little different.
Mm-hmm.
That quivery type style of Robin. And at the same time, when something's sort of mysterious, you know, it also creates a with the disco thing, as far as the stigma that, you know, you have disgraced music. How could you do that? You know, this disco, you know, what I call the rock purists. And I think I wanted to do the show because I think enough time has passed to give them more of an unbiased view of really what they made as far as their contribution. And I think that a lot of people, the mass appeal is the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, and rightfully so, one of the best-selling albums ever. But there was so much more to their music, and I think it all goes back to a tale of two bands. What a completely different sound. But I do want to point out, it really was a tale of two bands because they replaced the two fellas that were with them earlier. I think one was named Maloney, and was the name of the other one? Bryson?
It was Colin Peterson.
Thank you. So when they went to more of this disco-type sound, they actually did replace band members. I don't think we talk about that enough. So it really was a story of two bands. They brought in, as you guys already mentioned, from Mott the Hoople, Blue Weaver. They brought in a fellow lead guitarist named Alan Kendall, and they brought in another drummer, who I was, Dennis Bryan. And so you're talking not only a different sound, but a different group. So, of course, it's going to have a much different sound. And a lot of people at that point, when Saturday Night Fever came out, oh, wait a minute. You're telling me this is the same group last time we heard a lot on the radio? They were doing How Can You Mend a Broken Heart? There's no way that can be the same group. And that's just an incredible transformation. But I want to go back one other comment, and I'll open it back up to everyone else. But we're talking about Sgt. Pepper. Sgt. Pepper put the end to many groups, and as Dave said, in 67, who couldn't adapt. But
right.
in a sense, they also put the end to the disco sound of the Bee Gees when they made that terrible choice to make the movie along with Peter Frampton.
I have comments about
the
Lonely
Hearts Club Band movie in 1978.
Yes. That movie, fellas, John brought up a good point. That movie was doomed for failure the day it came out. When you tried to do something that only people was going to be accepted doing that was the Beatles playing themselves. And I read where Peter Frampton said, if I made one major mistake in my life when I signed a contract to be with the Bee Gees, and I've got the soundtrack of it, and Aerosmith was a perfect group of blue meanies, so it wasn't that. Alice Cooper was in it as a wizard. But when you try to duplicate some things, and I bet all you guys agree, you don't try to duplicate the Beatles. That's my opinion.
Well, I've never seen that movie. Have you guys seen it?
I have
seen
it, John.
I've actually seen it a couple of times. I got to admit, I kind of like it.
I gave it two boots.
I'm the exception.
But
yeah,
John,
I've never
John,
seen
I end up trading. John, didn't I trade you my soundtrack for Aerosmith Live?
That is correct.
Yeah.
That was an even trade, and I was quite happy with it. Okay. You know. But they actually had a hit from that. Robin doing Oh Darling became a top 30 hit from that soundtrack.
Oh, I didn't know that
you know.
Either.
Yeah, yeah.
And John, didn't Aerosmith chart too?
Come together.
Come together. That's what I thought, yeah.
But yeah. I will say this about the Sgt. Pepper. I even heard Barry Gibb saying this in an interview. He was like, we knew it wasn't a good idea because we wrote our own songs, but he said what helped us out, he said by the time we got done filming Sgt. Pepper, fortunate for us and for the movie company that made it, we were on top of the reel because the Saturday Night Fever movie was at its zenith. It was extremely popular, and so they thought, my gosh, aren't we lucky? We're the ones that got the Bee Gees in this Sgt. Pepper movie, and we're going to be putting it out here in about another 5 or 6 months. We can't wait.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, at Peter Frampton, at his top of his popularity, too, it had all the makings. It should have been very successful, except all four Beatles were still alive, and people thought,
yes,
if you're going to do this, it should be John, Paul, George, and Ringo.
The one person you guys don't realize, John, you probably know this, David Bowie turned down a part as the king of the Blue Meanies because he thought this is not going to work, and maybe Bowie got ahead of this thing when the rest of them didn't and everything. But I want to make a comment too about me doing something on the Bee Gees. I got influenced by the Bee Gees through my brother John. Everybody knows me well. I'm direct rock and roll. But when I heard that Life in a Tin Can album, I end up buying it and jive talking. It was the best workout song I could think of, and it's one of my favorite. And I just enjoy it. It just makes me feel good. And if I feel down, I'll put Jive Talking on. It's right up there with Hungry with by Paul Revere and the Raiders. I put that on when I feel down. And this meant, and I got to make the comment, Barry Gibb was on an interview one time and said, did the Bee Gees ever get to meet the Beatles? Well, in 1967, they were in London. Well, Paul and John were at the same party, and he said, the only thing I can remember about the Beatles is John Lennon didn't look at me, but he did shake my hand behind his back and kept on going.
Didn't even
and
turn
that's
around.
A real John Lennon story, ain't it, John?
Yeah. So I remember Barry telling me, he goes, I met him, but I'm not sure if he knew he met me.
Oh, that's great. I know they were big fans. That was what the Bee Gees influences, because if you listen, like the album that, I don't know if we've talked about the Bee Gees first, that was actually their third album, which I think is pretty cool that that's called the Bee Gees first.
Mm-hmm.
That is such a good album. I mean, I don't know where you guys put that album in your category of Bee Gees music, but you listen to that album, and that's every song is good, and it all just kind of fits together. It's got a real Beatly thing to it, but it's also, I mean, it's also theirs. You know, they own it but you can see the Beatle influence, hear the Beatle influence, feel the Beatle influence in that album.
Hey, John, another one is Lonely Days. The John Lennon echo at the end. Remember how John would do that echo and how they brought in the strings on that one? And I could see John Lennon doing that song and singing about Yoko that way. It wouldn't have surprised me.
The first time I heard Lonely Days, Lonely Nights, Where Would I Be Without My Woman, it was on WNCI in Columbus, and they didn't tell who it was. And I said to Dave, I said, my gosh, Dave, they found another Beatles record nobody knows about. And I had no idea it was the Bee Gees. I actually thought it was John Lennon singing lead.
Sounds like him.
Yeah, that's how I feel about the song Holiday, because I think that sounds a lot like the Beatles.
It does.
It does. And there's another song they made called Lollipop, which John knows is one of my favorite ones. And you got to really, it's on an Australian import. And they go lollipop, lolly. Then they all do the pop, right, John?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were kids when they made that.
They made that when they were 10 and 12 years old.
Yes. On TV. Now here's something else I want to say about the Bee Gees. Yes, I know Robin had his problem with drugs there for a while, and we know what happened to Andy. But considering the limelight was on them from 5 and 7 years old, overall, I thought they came out pretty darn good because they were under the public eye scrutiny almost their entire lives. And as a kid, and make that and be able to adapt into adult and continue, that's no easy task.
Right. It isn't.
A lot of artists, you guys, it's
survival.
A big battle. Yes. I'm thinking of the Beach Boys. You and JD brought this up about the Beach Boys. That affected Brian Wilson so bad and to the point where if you're under the public eye all the time, it would be tough. And I'm just using this for example. You think of – and I think that's what one of the breakups was broke up the Beatles. I know it was some business issues, but you get to a point you have no public life. Elvis Presley. Elvis had to rent a amusement parks by himself because – you're in the limelight. And, John, that's a good point about the Bee Gees. They kind of handled that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it can't be understated how big of a thing that was.
I agree. And all the temptations and the things that happen to a lot of people when they can't really handle fame. And you think that's what you want, and then when you get it, you think, I'm not sure if this is what I want or not. And then you see all the people that we've lost, you know, with that. But I do agree with you guys on, you know, the Bee Gees handled it well. I mean, you hear anything from Barry Gibb, I think Brady might still be on, but when you hear people talk about Barry Gibb and you quote him, he just seems down to earth. He seems, you know, approachable and somebody that can talk and not be full of himself or full of I mean, we talk about their songs, man. It's incredible. What, you know, some of their songs that are like How Deep Is Your Love? I don't think we've mentioned that tonight, have we?
Right. No, we haven't.
How great of a song is that? I mean, it really is a really good song.
I Started Absolutely. A Joke is a classic to me.
That's another sad song, David.
Yeah. But you know what that represents to me? You guys know I'm a part-time preacher, too. It always represented me the resurrection story of Jesus. If you listen to it, if you guys listen to it, I died, but everybody came alive. And I did that, and I brought that up at the church one time, and the old lady says, rock and roll. But if you listen to the lyrics, it was there. It's there. And it's amazing.
Hey, guys. I'm still here, and I've got in front of me what I quoted from earlier, the interview in Saturday Evening Post with Barry Gibb. On this idea of fame and money, listen to this. I wanted to sing lead, and so did Robin. Maurice had his own plans. We started leading separate lives and did too many drugs. Maurice tried to be the peacemaker, but more than anything, it was just that we needed time to become men, not boys anymore. And sometimes we became the Bee Gees again. So to that up and down that the, you know, the price of fame and glory, you know, they were able to deal with it somehow or other.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Thanks, Frank, for sharing that. Because, yeah,
that's a great point.
You know, and I will say this also, that if you have not seen the HBO special that came out in December, I think Brady referred to it earlier, the saddest moment toward the end of the movie, the documentary, is when Barry says, I would give up all the fame, all the hits to have my brothers back with me here again.
Yep.
I mean, that sums it all up. And you could tell he was very genuine about that, you know, as he was saying it.
Yeah.
It's something when you work with your brother, like John and I do the trivia shows across the country together, and it's a different atmosphere. People ask us, do you guys get along? I said, I'm glad sometimes there's 600 miles between us. Sometimes I think it helps. But the point of this, we're willing to work and listen to each other, and that makes – and I could see with the Bee Gees, if you have different band members, you'd probably be different. But brothers have that connection, and I think it has a lot to do with this. And I think it's that closeness of the brother, of the brothers.
Well, go ahead, Fran.
Yeah, in that One Night Only, the PBS special – to your point, you can see as the show goes on and, you know, they do the breaks for fundraising, but you can see where that bond, they're all equal. Now, granted, Barry gets most of the play, it seems, but when the camera goes, Dolly's back, you can see how these guys, they're all in the same They're all in the same soundtrack, let's say, and not anyone is trying to outperform the other. It's really moving, is what it is.
I haven't seen that, but I have to take the one you talked about, Fran and John. You talked about the HBO. I have to watch those because
I love that.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing better than that inside track. You know, you can hear their music, but what's their lives really about? And I will definitely put that on my list of things to watch. Well, we're running out of time. We got a little over 5 minutes. I would like to take a little bit of time here for you, for John and David, for you to say your closing, what you want to wrap up the show. And first of all, just thank you so much for being on. It's always so much fun to have you guys on, and I appreciate
always
you being
fun
on
to
through
be
the
with
years.
You, John. It is for all the years we've worked together, but I want to bring this up about the Bee Gees. No matter what, everybody, I remember one time somebody came to the house one time and said, David, did you actually listen to a Bee Gee disc? I go, yes. I said, I can't believe this, but let me say this. They're all artists have their talent, and you've got to give them all a fair shake. And to me, there's times I like their songs, and it was so great to get to discuss their ups and downs this band had, which we have ups and downs in life the same way. And I think it shows that if you're determined, you can make it. And that's just my point.
John?
I want to thank the listeners tonight and the callers particularly with some excellent points.
Great callers tonight.
Very good. Appreciate it. And I want to encourage people to go to timmonsrock.com, TimmonsRock.com, and you can learn more about the Timmons Brothers and our background in music. And we're in the process of trying something new. I don't know the details yet, but sometime this summer of doing a presentation through Zoom. And once we know more of the details, we're going to get the word out so you'll be able, just like tonight, in the comfort of your home, be able to see why we have the best faces for radio, because we will be on the screen.
I'm with you on that, buddy.
Okay.
Hey, John, if I could just real quick get this in. Again, this is from the Barry Gibb interview, and I think it's a great way to kind of put a string around everything and put a bow on top of it. Barry Gibb says, when we created together, it was like we became one mind.
Yep. So
true.
Yeah. And Fran, my other comment I was going to make, Fitz, thank you, because it you gave me a good prompt right into it. The show started with me talking about the commonality between the Wilson brothers of the Beach Boys and the Gibb brothers of the Bee Gees. And, you know, when the Beach Boys were really doing well, you know that those brothers and the cousin and the neighbor were all really uniting. It was just its own unique surf sound and hot rods and so on. But I can't help but think, but here we are in 2021, and both Brian Wilson and Barry Gibb are the only survivors from all their siblings. They had to put all their younger siblings go away and have to deal with death. I mean, it's uncanny, the similarities between the two bands.
Yeah, that's true. It's very good. Well, guys, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Fran, for calling in. We appreciate your input. Great things. Thanks, John and David.
Thank you.
Yeah, we just want to thank, like John said, thank the listeners, the people out there that have been a part of this show since 2008. And we've been putting the shows out. Tomorrow, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, we do a 15-minute music break, which is a lot of good music. We play old music and new music. So tell your friends about that. And, guys, thank you so much. Everybody have a great evening. And we'll talk to you all later.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Sunshine. You brighten up my day. In your way, I see you every morning outside the restaurant. The music plays so nonchalant.
I can think of younger days when living for my life was everything a man could want to do.
I could never see tomorrow.
How can you stop the rain from falling down?
How can you stop the sun from shining? What makes the world go round? How can you mend this broken man?
How can a loser ever win?
Please help me mend my broken heart
and let me live again.
I can still feel the breeze that rustles through the trees and misty memories the days gone by.
We could never see tomorrow. No one said a word about the sorrow.
How can you mend a broken heart?
How can you stop the rain from falling down?